This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You know, changing the constitution, as I said before, I don't think it's an easy thing. That depends with only parliamentarians. You know, a lot of stakeholders are involved in changing the constitution.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University in Ohio, on whether Zimbabwe's ruling party is on track to change the country's constitution. Details coming up. Also, the United Nations General Assembly debates a ceasefire resolution for Gaza. And innovators and investors gather to explore economic opportunities on the African continent. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Later today, the UN General Assembly will debate and likely vote on a resolution demanding an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the two-month-long conflict between Israel and Hamas. The United States last week vetoed a similar resolution in the Security Council. The U.S. and Israel oppose a ceasefire because they think it would allow Hamas to rearm. Washington instead supports pauses in fighting to protect civilians and allow the release of hostages taken by Palestinian militants in their deadly October 7th attack on Israel. The U.S. also has pushed Israel to do more to protect civilians in Gaza. To explain the General Assembly's planned vote, we have VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir on the line now from New York. Welcome to African News Tonight, Margaret.
Thanks, Yehias. Thanks for having me on.
So go ahead. Tell us why this session was called.
Well, it's because of the inaction in the UN Security Council. It's really kind of stuck since the beginning of the war, really, not just recently, but since October 7th. There were four failed Security Council resolutions calling for humanitarian pauses in October, and then the UN General Assembly took over at the end of October and agreed their own resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian truce. And then we came back to the Security Council, still looking for the stronger language of a humanitarian ceasefire and not succeeding. As you mentioned, on Friday, the United States vetoed a resolution calling for that. So the Secretary General has been very worried about the situation. He invoked something called Article 99 of the UN Charter, which he has never done in his seven-year tenure. And the last time a Secretary General did it explicitly was in 1971. So it's a dramatic move on his part to try and bring this situation to the attention of the Security Council and push them to act. But he failed. So now the Arabs and the Muslim countries have gone back to the General Assembly. This afternoon, they will vote on basically the identical resolution that failed Friday in the Security Council will be put to the 193 member states, and nobody has a veto there. Everyone's vote is equal. But the only difference is, technically, it's not international law or binding a resolution coming from the General Assembly. But if there's a high number, and we certainly do expect a high number of countries to vote in favor of it and for it to be adopted, then it sends a clear message to Israel and the United States and whatever countries continue to side with Israel on this issue of the humanitarian ceasefire that it is not the will of the international community.
I understand, Margaret, the General Assembly voted 121 to 14 on a similar resolution in October. Have attitudes at the UN changed since then?
Well, I would say frustration has grown. When they voted on October 27th, there were 7,000, roughly, Palestinians who had been killed. Today, when they pushed their button to vote, we're at more than 18,000 in 2 months. So I think many, many countries here are shocked at the scale and the speed of this catastrophe, really, that's on the Palestinian population, and they're very concerned about it, and they want to see it stop. So I think that they will top 121 votes today. So I think some people will get off the fence. There were 44 countries that abstained last time, so I think we might see some of them move into the support column. So it'll be interesting to see how the numbers shake out, because I think that will give us a clear indication of how the international community views this situation.
And finally, since the conflict began, there have been calls for the United Nations to act to bring about a ceasefire. Tell us what the United Nations can and cannot do in a situation like this.
So you have to look at the United Nations two ways. You have the UN Secretariat, which is Antonio Guterres and his staff, and they're the people who are doing the humanitarian work, for instance. But politically, their hands are really tied in terms of getting a ceasefire. The Secretary General cannot personally order the guns to fall silent, or trust me, he would have done it in many other conflicts before now. But then you have the UN, which is the 193 member states. And that's where it becomes tricky, because you have 193 opinions, 193 national interests, and that's what gums up the work of the UN and makes it difficult to find consensus. So it's up to today, it's up to those 193 countries to find a way forward to demand the humanitarian ceasefire.
VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir on the line from New York. Thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Also today, the chief of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philip Lazzarini, likened Gaza to hell on earth. He posted the comment on X, formerly Twitter, while he was visiting Gaza. The Israeli Defense Forces continue their assault on Gaza, particularly in the south. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 18,000 people have died there since the fighting began. More than 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals have died, most of them in the initial Hamas assault in October. Negotiators haggled today to find a compromise over the use of fossil fuels as the Dubai Climate Summit went into overtime, with Saudi-led oil producers resisting a phase-out of oil, gas, and coal. The 13-day UN COP28 conference has debated a historic call to abandon fossil fuels globally. Fossil fuels such as oil and coal are the main culprits in global climate change. But this morning's deadline expired without a deal. Yesterday, COP28 President Sultan Al Jaber, the head of the United Arab Emirates Oil Company, presented a draft that only suggested reductions in fossil fuels among several options. Many governments oppose that draft, especially low-lying island nations that warn their survival is at risk. Denmark's Jan Jorgensen, one of the climate ministers tasked with leading the talks, said the summit needed to be clear that fossil fuels were on their way out. Agreement reached at UN climate summits must be passed by consensus. Then countries are responsible for complying with the deal. The combined cost of COVID-19 pandemic and a civil war in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region that ended in November 2022 has left the country long seen as one of Africa's most promising economies, struggling to pay its debts. A senior finance ministry said Ethiopia will hold a call with its international bondholders on Thursday as the country is careening towards default, saying last week that it could not pay a $33 million bond payment due on Monday. Non-payment would put Ethiopia, which requested a debt overhaul under the G20 Common Framework in early 2021, on track to default after a 14-day grace period. But in separate comments made to Reuters News on Monday, Iyob Tekkaling, State Minister of Fiscal Policy and Public Finance, said authorities' intention is to remain current on our obligations. Ethiopia also is seeking a 4-year loan from the International Monetary Fund, which has said discussions with the government are ongoing and a staff visit to the country is likely to take place early next year. Zimbabwe's opposition has challenged the results of last weekend's by-elections, describing them as a sham designed to give the ruling ZANU-PF party a tighter stronghold on power. The opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC, also says an obscure political figure, Sengezo Shibangu, who was responsible for removing CCC members from parliament, is not the party's interim secretary general as claimed. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's party, ZANU-PF, is just 10 seats away from securing a two-thirds majority in parliament that would allow it to change the constitution. Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devry University in Ohio, discussed with me the politics of the weekend and whether ZANU-PF wants to change the constitution.
Well, I don't think the constitution can easily be changed, you know, because ZANU-PF has a majority in parliament. A lot of stakeholders are involved always when the constitution is supposed to be changed. And I think that is in the constitution itself. It's just like politics being played, that ZANU-PF wants to change the constitution. It has been confirmed by the vice president of Zimbabwe, General Chiwengwa, that that's not the goal of ZANU-PF. And what is really happening, it's just like confusion mostly from the opposition side. They don't have structures. They don't have anybody whom they can say, this is the secretary general. And that opportunity has been taken by somebody who is now claiming to be an acting secretary general, recalling members of parliament. And once, parliament receives that message of recalling party members, they have to act according to the constitution of Zimbabwe. So the blame game is there. Of course, ZANU-PF is a party that's so much old and rooted into Zimbabwean politics. I believe 100% that it has infiltrated the opposition to the point where they can actually do whatever they want, like maybe, these recalls. But I don't think it's something we can blame one party. Say the opposition must be organized. They don't have that.
Professor, let's talk about this obscure political figure you mentioned. It's Sengezo Shibangu, who declared himself the CCC's interim secretary general. And who is he? And he is actually making a difference on the by-election.
Yeah, he can be genuine, because according to what he said, well, they all know him, the leadership of CCC. And he was there when MDC was formed and then CCC was formed. It's only maybe now that they are, with what he is doing, they are claiming that they don't know him. But you look at the leadership of CCC, so to dismiss him without having someone we know is substantive, I don't think that works at all. The opposition brought it to themselves.
So why would CCC leader Nelson Chamisa, a former preacher who protested that Shibangu was not a party member and that no expulsions had been agreed, why would he say that?
So he should exercise his powers if he really meant it. He's just saying that, because he has to say it. It's politics. He can't keep quiet. But he obviously knows the person, and he can't blame himself for not having a Congress for the party to choose people who are going to be substantive. So he's trying to find a scapegoat and blame this and that. He's blaming Shibangu, he's blaming ZANU-PF. The only person he's not blaming is himself, which is not being a good politician.
And lastly, Professor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's party, ZANU-PF, is just 10 seats away from securing a two-thirds majority in parliament that would allow it to change the constitution. You think they're going to get the majority and then actually change the constitution? You think that they're heading that way?
Well, I think definitely they are going to get the majority. But, changing the constitution, as I said before, I don't think it's an easy thing. That depends with only parliamentarians. A lot of stakeholders are involved in changing the constitution. They need to change the constitution. And what part of the constitution do they want to change? Some people have said, well, they want to extend the term of the president, and the vice president said, no, that's not going to change. So I don't know what part of the constitution, may be changed because they have the majority, but I don't think that's the goal for ZANU-PF. They will definitely enjoy the majority and do whatever they want, but not touching much of the constitution, because I don't think some people in ZANU-PF want to go that way.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University, speaking with me from the U.S. state of Ohio. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. High-level experts and innovators are attending AfriNext conference hosted by the Atlantic Council and global development company DAL that is showcasing the strong business case of investment in African markets and the importance of situating investments and other partnerships squarely in local contexts. They're also sharing perspectives on all that lies ahead for the African continent, including the rising power of its youth, the impact of digitalization, and the threat of climate change. VOA staffer Anthony Labruto is at the scene in Washington and joins us live to describe what's going on. Welcome to African News Tonight, Anthony.
Hello, Yehia. Thank you very much.
So, what is the AfriNext conference hoping to address?
So this AfriNext conference is hoping to address, really on a wider scale, what's already been going on by companies and public institutions in the Western world, and that's cooperation, bridging gaps in education, human development, technology, things that are happening on a small scale or a corporation-by-corporation basis right now between the West and Africa, and concertgoers would like to see more of. A point I'd like to make, too, is that this conference is also including members of the African diaspora that are right alongside embassy staff, think tankers, policy writers who are actively listening and asking questions like, how does Africa conduct business? What can Americans do better to participate in African markets without overwhelming or dominating them? Really, the key theme here is a collective approach to increasing business in Africa rather than the case-by-case basis.
So why bring together members of the diaspora for an event like this?
Members of the diaspora, the African diaspora, particularly here in Washington, D.C., and we already know this, have a strong and powerful connection to each other and to their home communities back in Africa that are finally being noticed by the West. And African diaspora members are doing really amazing things here and throughout the country, in the Western world, creating art, developing technology, holding public offices, and doing it in their own way, and really reinventing and adapting many of the systems here in America really for their benefit and for their own benefit. And at the forefront of this has really been, as you pointed out in your introduction, the younger generations. With access to greater technology and communication back home, the future has really proven limitless for them with technology and also having that savviness to want to learn that technology, utilize it to their own unique advantage, unlike anything we've seen before.
And lastly, have Western companies and institutions been successful in tapping into modern African markets?
Absolutely. Going back to my first point, many of these Western companies and institutions really are already on the continent. But this conference is hoping to reframe a lot of particularly what bigger and medium-sized corporations, their business practices, how exactly are these companies doing business and what can they do to increase Africa's diaspora and in their home markets without completely taking them here, saying what many viewers on the continent, listeners on the continent already know, is that they know the markets, the people, and what's needed for them. And whether or not these Western institutions and companies really take heed to that and put in the work, we'll have to see.
VOA's Anthony Labruto reporting from the scene in Washington. Thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Kenya gradually restored power in the capital, Nairobi, and other cities this week after experiencing its third major blackout in 4 months Sunday night. The outage has only added to growing criticism of President William Ruto's leadership since he took office last year. Paul Nanatulia, senior researcher at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Kenya is struggling to recover from the devastating economic shock of COVID-19, which he says killed the country's tourism industry.
Tourism has always been a major foreign exchange earner for Kenya, and COVID-19 killed it. COVID-19 badly affected Kenya's textile industry. Kenya is a leading textile exporter in the region. In fact, Kenya does much, much better than many other African countries in taking advantage of the trade program, the U.S. trade program, the AGOA, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. Kenya has good backward and forward industry linkages. All that was really degraded by COVID-19.
Now, when you say degraded, does that mean like companies just went out of business and never came back?
I mean, people couldn't work, right? People couldn't work because there were movement controls, there were restrictions. People were very fearful. There were no vaccines. Even when vaccines were available, distribution was very, very difficult. So many of these companies were working at half capacity. Some were even working at below capacity. Others just shut down. Some of these businesses shut down. So the country has been trying to regain its economic footing, right? Persuading people to come back and visit and so on. And so President Ruto is at a very he sits at a very difficult time in Kenya, namely that, during the campaigns, he promised everything. He promised that he would be there for the common Kenyan, that he would provide subsidies, that he would finance, inject money in startup companies and so on. These have been very, very difficult to achieve in practice. In fact, if anything, it's been the exact opposite. So the fuel subsidies disappeared. Okay, fuel has gone up. Those are social safety nets that he was talking about, such as these direct cash injections. You know, these things have not been delivered as much, to the extent that was promised during the elections. So when you have these rolling power cuts that have put the country in blackouts, and it's not the first time. I mean, it's been happening since, I think there was one in November of last year, November, December, and then there was one in March, then there was one in August, and then these recent ones that you're talking about. It feeds into dark popular narrative that is emerging in Kenya about the Ruto administration failing to deliver on its economic promises.
And part of the problem, too, isn't it old infrastructure and corruption, too, in the government?
Yeah. Yes. Now, as someone who was raised in Kenya from I was an infant, and I've experienced Kenya when there are blackouts. I don't think that the power cuts per se will necessarily have an impact on the Ruto presidency thing or things like that, because Kenya has withstood very serious power cuts before. I mean, under the Moi administration, power cuts became endemic, right? So before Moi, I hardly remember. I mean, as a child growing up in Kenya, I think we had like one power cut. I think it was in 83. It was very noteworthy because there was no such thing as power cuts in Kenya. And so when the lights went out, it was like I remember even my parents, it was like, they took pictures as part of our photo album, the day the lights went out.
That was Paul Nanatulia, senior researcher at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme in Washington. Tributes are pouring in for award-winning South African singer Zahara, who died yesterday at the age of 36. South Africa's arts minister and Zahara's record company announced her death in a Johannesburg hospital where she was admitted last month. The French news agency AFP notes that in 2019, her manager revealed she was battling liver disease. Born Bulilewa Muktukana to a poor family in a village near East London, Zahara became known for her trademark guitar and giant Afro hairstyle. She sang in choirs as a child and taught herself guitar. Her voice drew comparisons to American performers Tracy Chapman and India Ari and to British star Joan Armatrading. She burst into the music scene in 2011 with her debut album Lolewa selling out in 72 hours. Zahara was billed alongside Huma Sekila, James Ingram, and Lauren Hill at Africa's biggest jazz festival in 2012. She released 5 albums and won 17 South African Music Awards, the country's top accolade. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.